Hey guys, welcome back to the Revive Stronger podcast. I'm your host, as always, Steve Hall. Today I have Andrew Chappelle back on the show. We dig into some of his recent endeavors into academia and some of the research that he's been looking at. You'll learn a little bit about citrulline malate and whether or not that's something you want to be taking. We dig into also his training approach and also particularly his nutrition approach during an off season and how that's changed over the years, how his thoughts have developed over the years as well, and how that might apply to you as a competitive bodybuilder or even just someone who's trying to maximize their muscle growth. Should you go into a surplus? What size of surplus? We also dig into some of the latest literature that's surrounding this topic and give you some general recommendations that's going to help you be your best. So if you're interested in learning about that, definitely check it out. And as always, guys, it always helps if you can share the podcast, give us a like, give us a review. If you're over on Spotify, it's super easy. You can give us a 5-star right there, or on YouTube, comment below, or at least give us a thumbs up and subscribe to the channel. It's highly appreciated. And as always, guys, enjoy the show. So Andy, as we were just saying off air, it's been about a year since we recorded last. It was episode 345, if people want to travel back to that. And we're talking about your successful 2022 season. So it's effectively been a whole year, and you've had a whole year of recovery and off season and improvement and all of this sort of thing. And I think it's worthwhile getting an update on what's happening with you, your training, competitive kind of foresights and things like this.
All right. First of all, Steve, thanks for having me on. And I can't believe it's been a whole year since we last talked. But once again, no, thanks for being a great supporter. You've always been great having me on to these shows. Where to start with all this sort of stuff then, right? A lot has changed since then. So I'm back in academia now. So doing the thing that I love. So I'm back working at university. So I'm at University College Birmingham now. I'm back doing research. Again, and I'm back teaching in sports nutrition at the same time, and I've launched my new nutritional consultation and competitive company. So you can find me, guys, at www.naturalbodybuildingcoach.com, or you can find me on the Instagram at the Natty Bodybuilding Coach, and I'm sure we'll put the links and stuff like that in the bio so you can look them up. So yeah, there's been a lot has happened. I don't know how we unpackage it all and how we go through this, but where should we start? What do you think?
The immediate thing that comes to mind, and I saw you start up that page. I don't know if it was, I think you did some collaborative posts with your Fueled Scott's Oats page. And I was like, how has that handle not already been taken? How's there not been someone else who's taken the Natural Bodybuilding Coach?
You know what? I was surprised at that. I couldn't believe it. I was like, wait a minute. That's not being taken. So I thought, you're saying exactly what you do, right? So I got the handle, and then I bought like 6 different URLs as well. I think I'm naturalbodybuildingcoach.com, and I think I'm also nattybodybuildingcoach.com, and I think I'm also nattycoach.com. So I think they all direct you to the page. If I've set the links up correctly, but yeah, I don't know how it wasn't taken. It seems so obvious, right?
Yeah, I don't know why. I just saw, I was like, I would have been sure someone would have just taken that name up. And but it's nice for you to have got that handle. It's very searchable, and for sure all of that will be linked below. And so yeah, I guess in regards to being in academia again, has that changed anything massively for you? Are you doing anything like that's sparked particular interests of yours?
Oh yeah, no, of course I have. I've got a paper which is being accepted, which is great. So that's coming out. That'll be coming out after April. So that's in the Journal of Sport and Exercise Science, I believe that one is, or it may be Science and Exercise and Sport. I forget the exact acronym. There's that many of these things. What it's allowed me to do to get back to academia is to start working on research papers that I wasn't working on previously, and get involved in stuff that I wasn't doing before. So that particular paper, which is coming out, I can talk about that. That's on citrulline malate. And I published 2 papers previously on that. So guys, if you're not sure what citrulline malate is, that's the thing that you find in pre-workout supplements, which has got that really sour taste in it. And on average, there's around about 2 to 4 grams that you find in your pre-workout supplement. Sometimes you can buy it as well as citrulline and malate in combination. And we've done some research on it previously. So 2 previous papers that I published, we did exercise challenges, exhaustive challenges, whereby we've seen how many reps can you perform over 10 sets. And you give someone citrulline malate, we take some blood markers, we measure muscle soreness. So we did that previously twice, published both of them. And on both occasions, we found out actually no effect. didn't really do anything at all. Now, there's a lot of reasons that could be the case, but we'll not talk about that. But I'm really determined to see if this stuff actually works or not, because quite easily we could have done the experiments wrong. Wrong populations, maybe they needed to be more sporty, maybe the dosage wasn't right, maybe the exercise challenge wasn't right. So I've got a paper which is it's coming out, where we did a loading dose. So you know, like creatine, so what you do is you load up on it first. We thought, well, let's try this. And we loaded the guys 8 grams a day, citrulline malate. I also got the sledgehammer approach. So if you give a whole load of this stuff and it doesn't work, then you know that a smaller dose obviously isn't going to work, which is more relative to what you find in the supplement. And results are in from that one. And actually, it's kind of confusing. It doesn't look like it actually necessarily seems to work in that example again. So that's 3 papers I've now done on citrulline malate, and not one effect has come off the back of it. I might do another one, because again, the big thing about hypothesis testing is you want to try and disprove your hypothesis over and over again. And if you keep coming up against this thing whereby it doesn't work, then you're pretty sure that it doesn't do something. Or contrary, if you keep trying to disprove it doesn't work and it keeps working, then you know that it's pretty solid it works. So that is quite cool. So I've been working on that. I've got another paper which I'm working on at the moment, which is on, I think this is cool. This is body dysmorphic disorder, eating disorders, symptomologies, and personality type. And we're trying to link in, does your personality type dictate if you're more high risk to any of those conditions? And we're doing that in bodybuilding populations. And I've managed to split people into the off season and the on season, right? And then I've got a control group, which is an athletic population at the same time. So I'm writing this one up. And you know what? It's the results of this, it's not what you'd think. So it looks like people get more comfortable with their body as they get closer to competition, as they get leaner. Yeah, people get right. Happy off of the back of it. And I think the sort of conventional wisdom around this is that the only reason that people would be trying to get in shape is because they were deeply unhappy, right? That's why you're maybe trying to control your physique. So that's looking kind of interesting. So there's still a long way to go in terms of writing that one up. But yeah, that's what I'm working on at the moment with that. And then I've got a few other things with intermittent fasting and so on. So going back to academia has allowed me to get invested with all these projects and stuff. And I love doing this stuff. It's great, yeah. Right? And next year I'll have a few other things that I want to do. I'm interested in mushrooms. So when you're working with coaches, sort of being a coach and stuff like that, as great as it is, and working with people, and you don't get to do this sort of stuff, right? So we've got a new psychology department. We'll get some lion's mane or something like that, and then we'll put one of these, I don't know what they're called, I think it's an EEG, and we'll put one of these on people's heads and measure electrical activity. We'll get them to do some exercise, and we'll see if these nootropics work or not. So yeah, I've been able to do all this stuff at the university. So things have changed in that respect. In terms of the bodybuilding, we've got a facility up here. And at the facility, we've got the high performance center. So I'm just training at the gym in there, and it's great. I love it. It's totally set up for my sort of power building style training that I always do, with big heavy chains and safety squat bars and boxes and barbells and all that sort of stuff. So it's a great setup here, and I'm thoroughly enjoying it. We'll see if it inspires me to compete again next year, though. That's the thing, right?
Yeah.
So does that answer the question?
Yeah, for sure. The academia stuff sounds really cool. And citrulline malate, I know it's supplements are a little bit of a minefield, I find, because there's just 100%. There's just so much there. And there's so much research on each individual supplement. Like, to become an expert on supplements is incredibly hard. So I really like, I don't know if you like examine.com. I find that website to be so helpful. So if no one's aware of that one, definitely hit it up, because they're kind of unbiased, delving into the research and getting all the studies and trying to find out, hey, what's this doing for us? How strong an effect it can have. I know citrulline malate was one of those where it was like, there's some studies coming out saying, yeah, it's doing something, and then some saying not really. And it seems to be kind of like neutral to, there's not really much going on there.
Yeah, 100%. And do you know what? This is a great point. And this is the thing that you see in the fitness world all the time, right? Is it very often when a new study comes out, people get really excited about it. And that becomes the thing in vogue, and people speak about it for 2 or 3 weeks. And then another new study comes out, and then people talk about that. But people rarely go back and look at the sort of track record for the studies to see, okay, well, let's add them up here. 5 of them say that it does nothing. 2 of them are saying that it does something. And 3 of them say that I know they're neutral or don't do nothing as well. But the ones that make the headlines are the big ones. So maybe you don't notice the other ones coming out as well. And then the other thing that happens is that when something's pioneering and new research comes out, so we had that paper recently come out that was talking about protein oxidation. You can have a big 100 gram dosage on that, and that'll be okay for maximizing protein synthesis all day. Well, there was what? Three or four other protein timing studies that had come out prior to that had actually shown a different effect, that the 25 grams of protein was enough to stimulate synthesis and you didn't get anything over that. So with that, you've got to kind of look at it and be like, right, we don't just suddenly throw out all that old research and you can't suddenly say that this is the new paradigm either at the same time. You see what I mean? We're still have to be cautious and sit back and say, okay, well, let's have another study and see if they can replicate that. And let's have another one, see if we can replicate that, instead of just saying, right, okay, this is the new thing that we're all going to do. And absolutely, that seems to be the way that the fitness world always goes.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. I think it's the, because you're the same as me. We've been, not that there was long before, there was most of my life there's been social media, I believe. So, but yeah, we were in the time where the internet wasn't a thing. There wasn't social media. So we're kind of doing all of this. So your information was, I don't know, muscle magazines or like the personal trainer and the jack guy in the gym. Whereas now you just have like, then there was forums and then like it developed into these other areas. But you're so right. It's, and even as a, like for you too, as a content producer, you kind of want to stay on not the cutting edge, but like the new research and put stuff out there. But importantly, try and, like you said, you'll put out these caveats of such and such, like bear in mind the body of evidence and where this lays within that. And it maybe just moves us in a slight direction. But unfortunately, people often just read the headline and they just take that as like, hey, this is the newest. That means that's the most up to date. That means this is the thing to follow.
100%. And people don't like, they don't understand statistics either, right? This sort of idea of this clinical significance and statistical significance, and like this is going down like a bit of a hardcore route with the stats on this one, but like we kind of go with like a result, if it's 1 in 20 or a 5% significance level, then we accept it as a true result in science, right? That, and I'm sure some people know what I'm talking about when I talk about probability. Well, listen, the same thing happens with scientific studies. You just, like, if you've got 20 studies, one of them is going to produce a result that's, it's going to go another direction just by the laws of probability as well at the same time. And that could be the first one that comes out. Like if you're the first one to publish in that, and then the paradigm goes completely in that direction. So yeah, it's tricky. And if you've got formal scientific training, you can stop yourself kind of falling into that trap with it. So gosh, yeah, it's hard, right? It's hard. Liam Norton does some good stuff though, I think. He reviews papers really well. And he sort of really waits a week or two before he puts something out to kind of wait the dust settle a little bit. And it's probably like that with journalism a little bit as well. That race to be first. So they captured information on the TikTok or whatever it is that they're capturing it. They put it out, there's a headline story, then the newspaper or wherever it is a few days later has got to make a retraction because they weren't right, because they've now got more information about what's kind of going on. So I guess I'm just saying exercise caution and just... It's interesting, but it might not be the full story.
Yeah, for sure. I think that's very well, like, it can't be stated enough. And it's nice to be able to these long form podcasts, because if I do bring on the people who have done the study, actually, if you read the actual paper, which most people don't, normally they talk about the other literature that's out there and where this stands within the body of evidence. But yeah, most people don't want to take the time to do that, unfortunately. And you mentioned, obviously, your training now. And you're kind of going through this power building style, and actually talking of like evidence that's come out, and I think there's been something that's been in vogue has been training at long muscle length. So I didn't necessarily think we'd go down this route, but I'm sure you've seen the discussion behind that. Has that influenced your training at all, or have you just been happy to continue as you are?
No, it's not. It's not influenced at all. So I looked at a couple of the meta-analyses that came out, and they sort of just suggested that training full range of motion was probably the best way to broach it. And I was like, yeah, that probably makes sense, right? So I just kind of continued to do what I was doing. But listen, people are always looking for that extra percentile to get that little bit extra out of their training. It's not a new concept. It's been around for a very long time. And it's just another advanced training technique that you can add to your training protocols, right? Just like doing drop sets, supersets, all that sort of stuff, you can put it in there to take yourself past the point of failure or to overload in a slightly different way, right? Or at least yeah, that was my take on it.
Yeah, I think it actually comes back to your point of kind of statistics and the significance of it. And you talked about like minor percentages. I think a lot of people brush past that and they're just like, hey, length and partials in some situations have been shown to be superior. So they just run with that. And it's like, but what's the difference and magnitude? And also what muscles have been studied over what time course and this sort of thing. So it's like, I have nothing against someone sticking to their kind of full ROM training. If you're doing short partials, Andy, I'd be like, hey, maybe you want to have a look at your training and do something partial, a bit better. Yeah. But I mean, it's the significance is not large. So I think that's fair.
Well, people get caught up in like when you read these papers on it's a meta-analysis invariably we're talking about, you get these things produced called effect sizes. And then an effect size is your small, medium or large in terms of it. But what does that actually translate into a small effect size in terms of actually pounds of muscle over the course of a year? What is an actual small effect size and how do you actually translate that into a gain? I don't know. I don't know. And is that the best way to kind of do it? But no, it's not a bandwagon that I've jumped on. Interesting though, I do wonder what the application is out with bodybuilding populations. There's absolutely probably use for that in rehabilitation. That seems to make sense. You could probably use that in terms of geriatric populations. Probably very, very useful. People have got an injury history. So there's probably very specifics where it's a great idea. Absolutely.
Yeah, for sure. I've enjoyed it. Like you said, it's so long as it's not something where it's, I don't know, you completely change your paradigm of training. It's just edged me in a direction and I've experimented with it quite heavily, to be honest. And I think it's been beneficial, but it's like, hey, it certainly hasn't made me worse. If it's made me better, brilliant, but it's nothing I'm too worried about.
Again, the other thing which you think about with this is you're always like a sample size of one, right? So it's like, if you put that time into doing the lengthened partials that you're doing, and you did it for say like an 8 week interventions on the last exercise that you did for all those things, you've got to kind of weigh it up with, well, what if I did something else in that time zone and that period, that was maybe a superset, or maybe I was doing matrix sets, or maybe I just did straight sets, or maybe it's reps in reserve for that one, or I did those ones to positive or negative failure. How much of a difference in terms of magnitude if I just put that little bit more effort into that last set anyway? Would have I got anything over and above that? And can you quantify that difference going back to the effect size? And does it really mean anything in one population versus another? So, yeah, I mean, useful to experiment. Absolutely. Definitely do these things. Good training should be fun. We should always be trying new things.
Yeah, and I think they're working on, I know Milo Wolf is the one who's been heading up most of this, but he's working on a pretty big study where they've got a lot of people within it, and there's like basically one half are doing all length and partials, the others is doing full ROM, I think. And so that hopefully will elucidate something. Obviously, there's individual differences, there's a lot of variables that go into it, but I think it could be interesting. And actually, I guess outside of training, then we're kind of branching into the topic of the podcast almost here with your nutrition. How's that look for you? And then the kind of the topic we'll dive into, obviously, is kind of nutrition for bodybuilders in their off season.
Oh, yeah, no, of course. You know what? I'm doing quite well at the moment, actually. I look pretty good. I'm going to say it, right? I'm in pretty good shape in my off-season and in better shape in my off-season than I was previously. So when I got ready to compete the last time, I was up at 94 kilograms. And you know what? That 95, 94 kilograms, that was a mistake. I never should have got as heavy as that because normally I sit around about 90 kilograms and then I start a diet from there, yeah? So now I'm around about 86 to 87 kilos, and you know what, this was not on purpose, Steve. It's just I got tonsillitis at Christmas time, right? And then when you've got tonsillitis, like, you can't eat, it was terrible. So I lost like 3 or 4 kilos, and some of it was water, but some of it was fat, and I was like, oh my god, I got back to eating again and getting back to, but I've just kept the weight off, and I was like, man, look all right at the moment, and I don't seem to have lost any strength from there. So if I'm to go on this this journey again and do it, then I'll be starting from this position, because it's easier when you've got a head start, I think, for it, and you get in better shape. And I think that's what the research kind of shows on this one as well. So we can talk about that, everyone.
Yeah, for sure. So, yeah, I guess, yeah, you mentioned the body weight. Do you tend to hang out at a body weight then? Do you kind of post-show, do you have like an amount of body weight you're looking to gain, and then you gain up to a certain amount of body weight and then maybe, I don't know, a mini cut or something like this comes in? Or do you tend to kind of gain up and then just hover and slowly gain and maybe maintain for an extended time?
Okay, so these are good questions. So someone's body weight, what's that great expression? Is that your expectations or your physique will always sort of levitate to the level of your actual effort that you're putting in rather than what you actually want to put in. I've said that horribly, haven't I? That's terrible.
Sounds fun.
It sounds about right. Someone else is going to be rolling their eyes when they hear this at the moment. When you do the contest, we all know how your body is depleted and how bad you feel and everything like that after a contest. Your hormones are all over the place. Your joints are typically sore, you're dehydrated, and the big thing you need to do after a contest is recover. So I've never been a fan of any sort of reverse dieting strategies. I don't think they're helpful. I don't think they're useful. And I think you need to try and restore the normality back in your life post the contest. So it's all about that. And in most sports, we take a break in the off season. We go on holiday, we have a little break. You take a couple of weeks off of training. So that's always been my thing, or at least that's been my thing since at least I've been a pro bodybuilder since about 2014. I just learned that if you're abusing your body all year, training really hard, you need that little break afterwards from there. So weight gain, if I compete about 79, 80 kilograms, and the goal is to try and get to about 83, 84 kilograms, probably at least within a month of being there. And that just allows things to start normally, but working better again. Yeah. Like sleep quality is better, depression in the season, all that improve. And then just where my body typically sits in the off season, when I get back to eating the amount of food that I usually do, which is probably about 2,800 to about 3,300 calories. That's kind of what I need for my walking about weight and for me to perform the best in the gym. It kind of just settles at around about that 90 kilogram mark in any case. And that just allows me to be able to look quite good. I'm not carrying excess about. My blood pressure is not high. I mean, like when I was about 94, it was higher. I've been heavier than that as well. And then it allows me to have the glass of wine at the weekend if I want to have it and have that day off from the diet if I want to have that break or whatever. So I just kind of always sit there in terms of the lifestyle, if you see what I mean. And then I've always been a big proponent of this sort of idea that you need to try and improve your performance all the time. So it's always about performance indicators. So can you get stronger in the gym with your 3, 5, 8, 10, 12 rep max on all your big lifts? So if you're improving in those things, I mean, I'm a very power building based sort of guy, right? So if you can do those things, then you're making improvements, right? And things that probably don't help you do that are being in calorie deficits for extended periods of time. So I've never been an advocate for the mini cut or anything like that during the off season phase, unless of course I was maybe going to go on a holiday and I'm thinking, you know what, I want to look a little bit better on the beach for when I go away. But even then, you know what? I mean, I've been in shape lots of times. So my bodybuilding's for me, right? I'm not trying to get in shape for anyone else to see me on the beach at the same time. So does that answer the question that you're talking about there?
Yeah. So it sounds like
a lot of that. That's what I do myself.
Yeah. So you get up like 5% above stage weight after about a month, which makes sense. Yeah. I think that's a great recommendation. I completely am with you in terms of reverse dieting. I've been there, done that, and that was just extending the pain for longer.
It doesn't make much sense. Doesn't help you. And I've talked to so many guys who have just been messed up with it. Like, I mean, not just physiologically, because their testosterone levels are still in the toilet because they've been trying to stay 3 kilos over stage weight or whatever it is that they're doing, but just muscle dysmorphic, body dysmorphic disorder off the back of it.
Yeah.
High food focus and all that sort of stuff. You got to give yourself a break and get back to normality and get back to training, which should be fun. At the end of the day, and if all that stuff's working, then that's where you want to be, right? So no, you need to do it. It definitely doesn't help. And the guys that I've seen that stay too lean for too long after contests, the time they come around to the contest the next year, they just end up almost being smaller versions of that they were the year before. That's what I've often seen.
Yeah, I'm completely with you. And so essentially getting back into a position of health, like you said.
Yeah, and you have to.
You mentioned performance. I kind of look at it You want to get to a body weight and stay at a body weight that you can perform in the gym the best, yeah. Because that's ultimately, I always said, it's the light that matches the fire for muscle gain. It's the stimulus for muscle gain. Doesn't matter what else you're doing. If the training isn't progressive and overloading, it's not going to promote muscle gain. And so that's your main focus. And I guess you kind of let your body weight hover up until that like 90 kilo mark. And then then at that point, rather than mini cutting back down, which is maybe something I might suggest, you just stay there at maintenance for a bit longer, or maybe that's the point of which you're like, hey, I'm going to start a prep for another season.
Yeah, that's what I do. I probably just stay about the 90 kilograms and just, you stay at that for the year or the 2 years that you're going to be at, just trying to prove it again. And then, do you know what? I might do like a pre-diet diet to think, right, okay, let's clean things up here. Let's tidy it up. And then that allows you to start at maybe this 87 odd kilograms that I'm kind of at the moment, right? And that just makes things a little bit easier when it comes to the actual preparation from there, right?
Yeah, that makes sense.
To this, as you know, right? It's what you have to do to be that 87 kilograms compared to what I've got to do to be the 90 kilograms. Like, I can be a bit more relaxed, and that happiness that I get out of being maybe the 90 kilos compared to the 87 kilograms might be worth it, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Maybe not worth being that 87 kilos.
Yeah, there's some, like, the people underestimate the stress reduction you get just from being a little bit heavier sometimes. And maybe 100%. You physically don't like how you look in the mirror as much, but like your social life is better. You feel better day to day. Performance in the gym is better. It's something that can't be discounted at all. So I think that's cool. And I guess actually a question, you mentioned this is what you do now and you've got heavier before. Has this therefore changed in previous off seasons? Have you allowed your weight to go up heavier? And would you still recommend that, or is that approach changed for you?
I wouldn't at all. Do you know what? There's caveats to all this sort of stuff. So I think this is the journey that the bodybuilder goes on when they start working out, or at least the young male bodybuilder, because we all want to be big, right? And I think when guys first start working out, they bulk. That's what they do. They get big, right? And then they do the first bodybuilding contest. And then there's this sort of idea of the rebound effect that you just soak up all the nutrients. I see you rolling your eyes there. Yeah, we're on the same page. And then you need to bulk again. And then you need to bulk again and get bigger and bigger. And then once you've done it a few times, you sort of realize that it's diminishing returns. It's like chucking a bouncy ball or a tennis ball. It bounces high the first time, and then it gets less and less and less and less and less, right? And that's just you getting less and less muscle gain every single year as you progress through your training from there. So that's the journey they go on. And then they get to the point, like say, they realize that actually it's not worth it. And then they start just staying kind of leaner in the off season. At that point, they're realizing that actually I'm better off being at this weight, that I wasn't performing any better at 5 or 6 kilograms heavier. I was feeling a lot worse. And then when I started my diet to get ready for the competition, it was much, much harder. And this is where the research kind of comes into this, that we can touch on this one. So there was a couple of studies, and this is like the bulking research, right? It's like, how much of a calorie surplus do you need to actually to gain the muscle mass? And the classic thing was, right, okay, 500 calories above maintenance. That's what you need. And when you look into that, you're trying to work out, right, where does this recommendation actually come from? Is it like, okay, was it the weight loss stuff? That we said, okay, to lose weight, you did a 500 calorie deficit, and that allowed you to lose that half a kilogram per week or whatever it was. And then we just flipped that around. And that's ultimately where I think that idea comes from. But the research on this, there's not a lot out there in terms of actually seeing what happens if you have a calorie surplus and you manipulate that fact and see, do you actually gain more muscle mass? If you look at the research, what you see is there's lots of studies whereby they take novice trainers, they put them on a 12 to 24 week training program. And at the end of it, you see that, okay, they've built more muscle mass. And in some cases, they've built more muscle mass and lost fat mass at the same time. And that's not uncommon for the absolute novice trainer. Yeah. So they get away with that sort of stuff. But in all those studies, there's the only thing they're looking at typically nutritionally is, are they eating enough protein? They rarely ever are asking the question, are you eating more calories? Are you eating less? So there's a total paucity, like I say, on that. And the studies that are out on it, the most famous one at the moment is the Helms one, right? And that came out, and that was a nice study. And that was the 7-week trial that they did. Was it 5% calorie surplus versus a maintenance calorie surplus versus a 15% calorie surplus, right? So 7 week resistance training study. I forget the exact split. I think it was 3 or 4 times a week that they trained. And I think it's about 17 individuals that they have in the study.
Yeah.
And what they did was they measured the increases in body fatness over the course of the study from the start to the end. And then they measured the amount of muscle mass that they gained from the start to the end as well. And what they show quite nicely is actually, okay, they all gain about the same amount of muscle as each other. It's just that if you're in the 5% calorie surplus group, you gain more body fat than if you're in the maintenance group. If you're in the 15% calorie surplus group, you gain even more body fat than the 5% and then the maintenance group. So what you get from that is that actually having even that little of a calorie surplus just seems to lead to body fat accumulation, right? So that was that study. And then the only other study that I've seen on this, and there might be another one, I can't remember exactly, was I've got it written here, Garth et al. In 2012, they took elite athletes and they gave them an ad libitum diet, and that just means at leisure. And they did nutritional counseling with the other group to try and look at muscle mass gains. And then what they did in that was the nutritional counseling group to try and gain the muscle mass, they end up with a 500 calorie surplus, and they did it over 12 weeks. And what happens is, the group that gets the extra 500 calories in their diet, they gain 15% in terms of body fat. The other group gain about 3% in body fat, and they both gain the same amount of muscle. So like it's the results are in agreement with the Helm study from this, that just having that excess calories doesn't translate necessarily into the excess muscle mass. Now, there's always caveats, right? But does that always make sense? And does that square with what your expectations are?
Yeah. So I think, like you said, there's not been that much research. Like,
it's so limited. There's not a lot.
The Garth paper is what people hang their hat on for quite a while, and is an interesting paper because also those guys are all athletes doing other things.
Yes, yeah.
Training wasn't like, they weren't bodybuilders in the gym training five, six times a week. So, and the same, and this is kind of where I would only put like the slight, I guess, to play devil's advocate, the same with the Helms one, like the biceps grew, nothing else really grew. And they grew slightly more with the higher calorie intake. And it's like, if training is like really optimal for muscle growth, do you grow more by having more of a surplus, or is it worth the trade-off of fat gain? It's kind of one of those, right? Those sort of situations. So, but I think that take home that you mentioned, like essentially what really scales with the size of surplus is fat gain. Muscle gain doesn't change that much.
No, not at all. I mean, if you even talk about the Helms study there, and you're talking about bicep size, I mean, he did all this stuff with skin folds, and I love skin folds. They're great, right? Really, really good. But we call that a basic two compartment model. So all you're measuring there is fat mass and fat free mass. So you want to do like an MRI, right? And then you see, okay, so the arms grow, right? But if you do an MRI with it, then what you can look at with that is you can see intramuscular, are you increasing the total amount of subcutaneous fat around the bicep? Is it fat infiltration within the bicep? And we don't know that, right, from that study because we've not got access to that information. And look, I'm not discrediting that study because they've done great and that's difficult to do those studies. But we're kind of limited in the number of studies that are out there and the tools that we're using and so on. But if there's any budding sports nutritionists out there and people that are looking at projects to do, this is one you could absolutely do. And it wouldn't be, I say it wouldn't be too difficult. It'd be difficult to do. Maybe I should try this one then, try this one myself. But yeah, that's what you see. I mean, I think it's interesting, right? If you think about the training experience of an individual, I always sort of say this to folk. When you first start training, you're probably looking at something in the region of about 2 kilograms of muscle mass in your first year to about 4.5, if you're at that high end of the scale where you're a high responder, right? And then every year you could probably say, I don't think it's too controversial, the amount of muscle that you're gaining probably gets halved, right? So first 2 kilos, then you 1 kilo, then you half a kilo and so on, right? By the time you've been training for 10 years, even by the time you've been training for 7 years, if I can gain 100 grams of muscle in a year, it's pretty good going, right? So what's that a month? Like it's like, what, 7 grams or something? It's less than that.
Yeah.
So do you need to have 500 calories a day as a surplus to grow 7 grams of muscle in a month, which might translate into what's 7 grams in a month over 30 days? Like, it doesn't make sense, right? It does make sense that you need more calories to grow. Yeah, it makes absolute sense because one's an anabolic process, protein synthesis, it's energy expensive in terms of the dynamics that are going on there. So you need something, but how much more do you actually need?
Yeah, it's a really good point. It's made me definitely, it's funny, you talked through like the bodybuilder's journey and I definitely had that kind of, I almost call it like a fat bulk where you're just like gaining, I was eating all the right foods like clean and surely I'm just going to gain muscle and I just gained a lot of fat, stripped that back. And then I got very like insecure about gaining at this point.
Yeah.
So I kind of, and you mentioned holding yourself too lean. I definitely stayed too close to like a stage weight. My performance in the gym wasn't the best. I didn't feel my best and I didn't push body weight up high enough. And I'm like, in hindsight, I looked at that and I was like, oh, it was the surplus that allowed the muscle growth. But was it actually just being at a higher body weight, allowing my performance to be better? I'm not sure at that point.
100%.
But the longer I've done this, definitely. And I mean, anecdotally, we always see this. Like everyone can say the larger surplus they've been in, certainly they gain more fat. Like everyone can be sure of that. Did you gain more muscle? I don't think people are very confident in that conclusion.
No, absolutely. You do often train better though. That's the thing when you're that little bit heavier. I mean, when I worked with the strongmen, the expression was always mass moves mass. Like 100%. Your leverages change and stuff like that. So you're training more heavyweight. You can do more in that respect. And maybe that translates into more muscle mass. I don't know. Because the other thing is, because you've got to come back down the other end. Because you've got to lose the weight, right? And this is a classic thing that we talk about in terms of nutrition as well. There's this idea of the one quarter rule, where for every kilogram you lose, a quarter of what you lose is likely to be muscle mass. Now you can modify that, right? So by having a good quality diet, which is high in protein, that absolutely helps you, right? So to minimize the loss, doing resistance training absolutely helps you to lose minimize that loss. But at the same time, the longer you're dieting for, right, if you're on a calorie deficit for a long period of time, you know what it's like, the risk of losing the muscle just seems like it increases exponentially, and that just becomes much, much harder at the other side. Yeah? So if you're starting from a better place, absolutely makes a difference.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. And I think it's also one of those where I definitely wouldn't recommend like someone who's just getting into the gym started to just eat at maintenance the whole time and they'll be fine. When they're initially starting, if they're high in body fat, certainly that's like a great recommendation. They're probably going to recomp really well. But to gain the amount of muscle that you've got now, Andy, from when you started, you probably needed a surplus to just get to that level of body weight.
Absolutely, absolutely. In fact, most people, when they first start bodybuilding, like, they don't know anything about nutrition, right, at all. So they're probably, how many people do you encounter just your average Joes, which aren't even eating maintenance calories from there? So like just eating those calories gives your body the nutrition to allow you to then grow. And as we said right at the start, like it's that bouncing ball effect. If there's a time to bulk, it's right when you start. Because your body's going to be able to do something with those calories. And the longer you do it, you definitely, it's definitely not helpful. I can talk about some studies here, which you'll find interesting, which tie up this. There was a paper that came out a few weeks back, published 2024, Pablo Jimenez Martinez, and he did a paper on supplements and natural bodybuilding populations. So what supplements are natural bodybuilders eating, right? And it's all the same ones that you'd expect them to be utilizing, protein powder, creatine, fat burners, etc. from here, right? And the other thing they did though that I think kind of went under the radar was they did the same thing that I did in the paper before, so which I published on the Natural Bodybuilders, which they categorized people on, did you perform well at the contest or did you not win at the contest, right? And no one's really talking about this, but what they see, right, is there's a statistical difference between guys that diet longer for the show. So you diet that little bit longer, that makes a difference. You're more likely to win. If you start your diet a little bit leaner, that probably helps you as well. If you've been training for more years in terms of doing bodybuilding, that makes you better at bodybuilding. Surprise, surprise. If you do more contests the year before, that makes you better at it as well. So you've just got more stage time and more experience, right? So doing three contests versus two, you know how important that sort of stage experience actually is, right? And then the other thing that happens with this as well is that ties in quite nicely with the research that we published as well at the same time, where we look at, okay, did you perform well in contests versus not performing well in contests? And what do pro bodybuilders do versus amateur bodybuilders? And again, pro bodybuilders, the high level amateur guys, they diet for that a little bit longer. They're starting their diets in a little bit better condition. They've got a little bit more experience in terms of getting ready for bodybuilding contests, and they've got more years of training under their belt. So there's all these other variables, yeah?
Yeah.
But those things definitely matter, right? So tying it all the way around to, you're just like, yeah, that does not surprise me, right?
No, it all makes sense, especially for the level of condition that's now demanded on a natural bodybuilding stage.
Yeah.
And with all of that, not only are those people in a better position to get leaner, they're also in a better position to maintain that muscle mass, not have to rush the fat loss phase at all, maybe peak better, all those things. So that makes a ton of sense.
Do you not see the progress you would like? Are you sick of writing your own programs? Or perhaps you need some accountability in order to stick with the plan? Then it's time to start working with us. We at Revive Stronger offer a truly personalized coaching service. You'll get more than just an email with some macros or random cookie cutter program. With Revive Stronger, you will be the center of our attention. You will receive your own fully individualized training protocol alongside a customized nutritional strategy. We create the coaching around your needs, wants, personal preferences, and your own unique lifestyle. Every single week, we delve into your program in order to make appropriate adjustments so that we get the most out of your time and the best possible outcome. We help both female and male athletes to seriously change their body composition by adding more muscle mass and decreasing fat tissue. No matter if you're a competitive bodybuilder or just want to look better, if you need help with your progress and taking your physique to the next level, our coaching is for you. It's time to make a change. Sign up today and let's revive stronger.
No surprise really when you break it down that although there's all these different variables and things like that that you can adjust from here, definitely that the longer time you spent in the gym, the more muscle that you've built, etc., then the better you tend to get on at the competitions. And if you just stay that slightly leaner, it seems that might make a difference. If you're dieting slightly longer, that's that classic thing as well, where we've got the slow weight loss versus the rapid weight loss. Not if you compare, like, say, 20 weeks of dieting versus 24 weeks of dieting. Yeah, maybe those extra 4 weeks make a slight difference from there. Not that, like I say, 20 weeks of dieting is rapid weight loss or anything like that, but you know, just having that extra time in the bank always seems to make a difference, right?
For sure. Like I always say this, like clients who are, I'm sure you have this, Andy, clients who don't want to start prep yet. Maybe they're like, oh, can we gain a little bit more muscle, like a couple more weeks? I'm like, hey, those couple of weeks in prep count for like more than double what they count in your off season. Like the amount of muscle, like you said, you're going to be gaining in those 2 weeks, so little, but the amount of fat you could lose is substantial. So I'm always like, a little bit more time than you need is better than like not enough time.
Oh no, 100%, because you just don't know what's going to happen in prep. I mean, you'll know this, like if you work with, just say, if you've got 20 clients you're working with or 30 clients in a year, guaranteed one of them's going to have a breakup, one of them's going to move house, unfortunately someone in the family is going to pass away. They're just, things just happen in people's lives. So you just want that extra bit of time just to kind of manage people at the same time and be prepared with all this stuff.
I like that. Actually ties into a bit of the discussion we had at the start, because I think when you do it that way too, your recovery post-show, assuming you have that kind of aggressive post-show recovery, somewhat aggressive, like it's not like eat everything you can in sight, but gain
significant,
you don't want to go the other way. But that recovery process is easier because the kind of diet down hasn't been as torturous. You've got more comfortable getting into that position versus, I think about it like, I don't know, going down a Formula One track as fast as you can and then the bend is just horrendous. Whereas if you can go a bit more controlled, a bit more steady towards the end, that bend transition period is a bit more comfortable, then you're back on a straight and narrow. So I like how that suggestion of your, like it ties into every phase in terms of staying a little bit leaner and not pushing your mass to the point where you have to diet for such an extended time, or you do a pre-prep phase like you mentioned.
No, 100%. I completely agree with you. And it's like that sort of classic effect. If you do something extreme, then the other side of it's going to be extreme as well in terms of how you broach it. So 100%, totally agree.
And I think something, I guess, to tie in a little bit to the discussion of training age, because we're in a very similar position where I think we're in agreement, like much of a surplus for us isn't doing much more than maintenance. And there's no real benefit to us pushing, I don't know, 20%+ over our stage weight. It's probably not a great decision for us due to the journey down. And as long as we can train productively in the gym, see progressive overload, that should be our main focus. But for someone who's earlier in their lifting career with so much more muscle growth potential, they're the ones who will benefit more from a slightly more of a surplus, and they'll be in a position to be able to benefit from that. Is that fair?
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. I think that's fair. And I think that Helms paper and the Garfield paper, if that's how we pronounce it, it kind of shows that, okay, you don't want to probably go that 500 calories above the surplus. They didn't do it as a percentage, but 5% probably is all you need, right? Rich Piana was right all along.
So. Yeah, no, I know it was interesting, even at in the Helms paper, the guys who, whatever surplus they were targeting, they ended up in the same place. I can't remember how much of a surplus they were in, but it's like they were targeting 5% and 15%, but they ended up at the same percent over. So it's like, if you're really trying to track a precise surplus, it can be challenging. So I'm kind of like, hey, maybe this 1-2% of weight gain per month is a good general recommendation. For someone like us, go towards the slower end. And if it's nearer maintenance, that's okay. Don't stress about it. For someone who's nearer, got more muscle growth potential, less training age, they can go towards the higher end. If they're a little bit above that, I'm less worried about it. But kind of that's how I kind of scale it. I like to think about muscle growth potential because particularly the recomposition papers that I know Chris Barakat's done a lot of work on kind of consolidating that. They found like, hey, we can recomp when we're advanced. Like this is a thing we can actually do.
Oh yeah, yeah, no, absolutely. You definitely can. You definitely can. If you're over fat, then definitely
particularly
yourself back in shape. And I probably end up over fat post the contest, and then a few months after I've kind of sort of rebalanced things. There's another interesting side of this thing as well, is we need to be careful when we're talking about this stuff, because we're talking about calorie surpluses, right? And not really going into that, consuming far too much for the sake of muscle, for fat gain in here. That doesn't mean that you can't manipulate your calories in a periodized manner at the same time, because you're going to go through phases of harder training where you're absolutely pounding yourself and you're maybe training five, six times a week, right? Maybe you're an athlete who's doing double splits or whatever. And in those circumstances, then you need to eat more calories, right? But it just means that your maintenance goes up, right, at the same time. So there is a call for that. And when you're doing less, it just means that you've got to be also conscious at the same time of bringing it down at the same time, yeah? Because, I mean, we've all really killed ourselves in the gym. And you know what? It comes to the end of the week and you're just exhausted. You're like, oh. Then you know you probably should be eating that a little bit more, right?
Sure, yeah, I think.
And the way you know is you just weigh yourself every couple of weeks. You'll know.
Yeah, I was going to say, is that something you do? You track your body weight over time?
Yeah, I do. As you get closer to contests, that's when the contest prep, that's when I start tracking my weight more occasionally. In the off season, probably once a fortnight. See what I'm doing. If I'm getting a little bit too heavy, I'm like, okay, better rein this in a little bit. And if I'm too light, I'm like, all right, cool, I've probably got a little bit more latitude here at the same time, right? Because I'll know. Yeah. And the other thing that happens as well is, when you speak to guys that have been doing this as long as me, and I'm in my late 30s now with doing this, and I speak to guys who are in their 40s and their 50s that are bodybuilding, and by the way, guys, doing it, fair play to you for doing it as long as that as well at the same time. The health consideration is much, much higher as well. You're thinking about stuff like cholesterol, blood pressure, blood glucose. You're just sort of thinking about different things in life at the same time that as a young man, you're just like, give me that 10,000 calorie challenge, right?
Yes, I totally see that. And it's funny, I've noticed this in people around our age getting into like 30s, mid 30s, and definitely seeing a shift in perspective in terms of like just all about maximizing muscle growth. And now it's like, oh, maybe there's some like health considerations I need to think about.
Yeah.
Maybe do some cardio or whatever. I'm still about the maximizing muscle growth, but I have those thoughts as well. But thankfully, I'm one of those people that naturally, I struggle to actually get much above stage weight anyway. So I don't know. You know Chris Palin, actually, as a side note.
Yeah. Wow. What a great competitor. Yes.
Yeah. So unbelievable. So yeah, this is something that I asked him. I can just remember speaking to him backstage, and I was like, what's the secret? I was joking. Like, what's the secret to getting the crazy condition he gets? But he did mention he really struggles to push his weight much above stage weight, and he has to eat a lot. So it kind of just rings true to this discussion of, like, if you want to really come with that kind of pro caliber condition, like, staying leaner definitely seems to help some of these individuals. Obviously, he's got a large propensity towards being able to do that.
Yeah, no, 100%. I mean, you're talking about genetics here, really, aren't you? Yeah. And I've written an article, which is on my website, about genetics. And I think I listed 20 traits, I think, which are probably useful for the bodybuilder. And being able to have that propensity to get lean is absolutely one of them. And some guys, it's going to be a much, much harder journey than others. Some of them, like you're saying, you find it difficult to gain the weight. And that's where we've got to individualize the training program and that, or the nutritional program. And that's where it's good to work with a coach, because they can work with someone and they can help you say, right, okay, this guy can take on quite a lot of calories, more so, and he's not getting fat, but his training's improving and it's getting better and better at the same time. So there's value in it because of that. And a lot of this is, as you say, it's genetic. I think women are an interesting discussion point. In this, and that, because in my experience, you just find it that much harder to get the body fat off them compared to the guys. Like the studies we published show that they have to typically diet for longer, and when they're dieting for longer, they don't get as lean as the guys. Mm-hmm. Right, their starting point is obviously higher in terms of body fat, but they're working a lot harder in terms of the amount of cardio that they're doing as well, which means that staying lean in the off season becomes even more important for the female competitor, and not doing the bulk. Yeah. It's really important in that respect, because it's just that much harder to get it off. Much, much harder.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I'm a little bit more pro being in a surplus than you are, like on the side of like, I like there to be a surplus if we can be there, but I've definitely changed my perspective of like, hey, if we're not in a surplus, I'm not stressed that we have to make sure we are every single week. Like, I'm much less anal about that. I'm much happier about that. But I'm definitely on the same page with you, where there just doesn't seem to be much of a benefit of going really high. Like, I don't know. Where yeah. Have you heard bear mode?
Bear mode?
Yeah, there's bear mode.
That sounds like a variation on beast mode.
Yeah.
I've not heard of bear mode. But yeah, I can imagine what it is.
Jeff Nippard, I think,
oh, is he bear mode?
Potentially like made that like a thing. And I get it in terms of the performance. Some people really like perform very well there. And like, if you look at sumo wrestlers, they have the biggest fat-free mass index, right? But they're not getting on stage as a bodybuilder, because you lose a lot of that. So it's kind of, you have to be careful about not pushing it too far, for sure.
Yeah, I'm just, like I say, I'm always performance. Get the calories that you can perform, and that your life's working. And if we're performing really, really well there, then that's what we want to be doing. Absolutely. From doing that. So.
Yeah. And I think Chris has did good work on this too, where like, when I think about the things that aren't looked at in studies are the things like, hey, how's your sleep quality? That yeah. can have big impact on how nutrients are partitioned and performance in the gym, things like yeah. this, how stress, mm-hmm. all those sort of environmental factors, they almost can play just as large a role as whether you're not, and you're in a slightly larger or lesser surplus there. So I think those factors can start becoming more of a focus for people that are really trying to maximize muscle growth. Like, don't just focus on being in a surplus. That's not the key to growing. It's that performance in the gym, which is then complemented by good environment in terms of sleep, stress, those sort of lifestyle factors.
Yeah, no, I totally agree as well. I totally agree as well. In fact, I don't know how useful this podcast is going to be for your listeners, because I agree with you on nearly everything.
So that's a good thing.
Get a lot of confirmation bias here. What are the questions that you think that are potentially that we might disagree on?
Oh no, I don't think. I think where the difference, I don't know where I specifically land on this now. Mm. I used to, where you described recover from your contest, then yeah. you're in a, like, your weight bot hovers up to this point where you feel
yeah,
very good.
Progressively gets back to where you were before, more or less.
Yeah. So, and then at that point, you're just a case of, hey, basically maintain this and essentially aim for that kind of recomp, essentially.
Yeah.
I might prefer to ensure I'm in a slight surplus during that time and utilize mini cuts very sparingly. But mm-hmm. I think I actually have learned in the past, I abuse those a little bit much, because I agree with you. A mini cut can take time away from being in a productive position to be able to perform in the gym. So the mini cut really is like a only if it needs to be in there. So for example, if you're a little bit too far above like a stage condition, you want to cut down, or if appetite, for me at least, appetite completely tanks at some point where I still am decent body comp, but I just need to have a reset there. So I kind of view that as a bridge, where in the past I think it'd become a deficit where I'd have to come out of this kind of hole and then recover from it and I'd lose time, whereas now I'm just like, hey, it's just buying me more massing time versus the other way.
But really
I haven't, only until the last, I don't know how many months it's been, I've been at the same body weight. So for about 5 months, maybe that's a bit on the high end, maybe 4 months, I've been sitting around the same body weight and just focusing on training in the gym hard. Yeah. And like, I can't say I haven't been able to hit new PRs. I certainly have. And I think my body composition has improved. Obviously, that's me in my individual situation, but I'm becoming more convinced that that is a decent solution. I think that, a surplus is probably your... Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I think your best solution to grow muscle is probably a surplus, but is it worth the trade-off of some body fat that's maybe going to shortcut the amount of time that you can spend being progressive in the gym? That's kind of my, like, it's like kind of, road you're going to take?
I mean, the question I kind of had, I forget who wrote the paper, what's he called? Gary, he wrote the paper with the Helms as well. Oh, gosh, Helms is prolific. And they were talking about the amount of calories you obviously need as well to get the anabolism. And then they broke it down like I suggested. If you're only gaining, say, 7 grams of muscle a month, then it only translates into literally nothing per day on this. And they were making the point that, well, who's to say that you can't just utilize some of your fat reserves that you've got on you at the moment to just help you build that extra little bit of muscle mass that you need on your body that day. I mean, anything that you're eating in terms of excess and protein anyway, you either oxidize or you're going to use it, or so, I mean, who's to say? It's difficult. I don't know. I don't know. And listen, I'm open to having my mind changed as well.
Yeah, I think I'm on that side of, like I said, really trying to maximize things. So I'm like, if there's anything I can do to make that process, which is so painful, especially as you're more advanced, to grow muscle, man, I want to grow it. But it is a case of, if you go too assertive, you could lose everything you gained when you have to diet that extra fat off.
Yeah. So does it actually matter when you go around it?
Yeah.
That's why the performing aspects, and I love powerlifting, as we like to call it, power building, sorry. So I'm always doing things with like chains. I did that for a long time, or like bands, or like squatting onto a box or something like that, or doing like plyometrics and stuff like that alongside my bodybuilding training, which is not conventional in terms of what bodybuilders typically do, because I'm always thinking, right, if I can maximize my growth in those big three lifts, and doing those things allow me to get those incremental improvements, then that's maybe going to be the way that I need to kind of focus in terms of maximizing performance for that, rather than maybe this extra little bit of calories on there. Plus, I think it's really fun.
Yeah, I think the enjoyment aspect of training, it's one of those things that a lot of the, like, I don't know, optimal bros, I call them that, we'd like to poo-poo. Like, I like to take out psychology, like, and just focus on the hard data. But it's like, psychology is so important. Like, and power building, I think, can definitely be done in the right way, complementary for sure for someone's results. And I used to be quite counter power building as well, where I was like, no, specificity is king. You must be all bodybuilding. It's like, I think you can do some of the power building styles in a pretty complementary way. Is it the way I'd like definitely always program for people? It isn't. But if someone has a preference for that, I certainly wouldn't be against it.
I will tell you this though, Steve, that the amount of injuries that I've had in my career. Now, a lot Fair of that amount. Is because I'm stupid, right?
Right.
And I've got an ego. So just like, oh, it's a little bit of pain, I'll just train through this, right? And then it becomes a big bit of pain, right? And that's on me. But at the same time, it's that sort of classic thing. Would I have managed to get to the level that I'd ever got to with this sort of stuff, if I hadn't done that sort of stuff, I probably could have got more longevity out of my career, I feel, because aches and pains and injuries that I've managed to accumulate from that, if I'd just done a few more weeks of just specificity and doing some more machine-based weights, probably would have helped, right? But I don't know if I would have enjoyed it as much. But I picked up a few injuries. So yeah, there's definitely, what's the expression? There's definitely trade-offs.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I think with a lot of these things, so long as you're within certain parameters that make sense, that we've kind of talked about here, where it's like, I don't know, you're not a advanced bodybuilder in the off season and like trying to maintain your kind of competitive condition and then trying to recomp from there, that's not going to work. Like that's going to be a horrendous position. If you've got plenty of body fat, you're performing well in the gym, that's when that sort of scenario can be potentially useful for you. And it's, yeah, I think it's similar with a lot of these things. As long as you're within these kind of guidelines and general reference ranges, that's about as optimal as we can very well know. And if there's a certain path where you're like, hey, I like that, you're going to be better at probably doing that thing.
Yeah, no, 100%, 100%. And that inter-individual variation you're talking about is important too, because with all these studies, even though we're very often only ever talking about the average, the mean, this is the mean result, and this is how most people are probably going to get on with it. And that's where the coaching comes in again, which is someone might perform slightly better with that calorie surplus than someone else. Yeah, because again, it's just the averages. But it doesn't mean that you should use that as an excuse just to go and go down that route anyway, right? Because most people are the average.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very true. And I think you can kind of see it in the person as well if you're coaching them and you're keeping an eye on things. And like you said, muscle growth is so slowly, like going so slowly, like there's no point trying to rush that process. There's no benefit to it. If you're a bit more at maintenance for a period of time, then that's fine. You can just keep going for longer probably. So I think we're pretty much on the same page with most things. Like you said, there are very, very few differences. And yeah, I guess I actually swinging back around, you mentioned competing again. So you have no like things on pay, like you've penciled in a stage on time or a time on stage rather, I should say.
A time on stage. I've not got anything in for this year. I'm not going to do it this year from here, because that the contest prep that I did in 2022, when I went through that whole thing, and I must have talked about it on the last podcast that I've done, I was actually completely broken, right? I had like disc issues and things like that getting ready for that show. And it's pretty remarkable that I managed to do it. So again, the power building guys, there's trade-offs, but I've obviously got ability to manage a pain threshold to a point. So this last year, so 2023 was all about trying to get back to where I was in terms of strength and so on. And I did pretty well. Like I got back up to doing a 220 squat, bench press 150 plus again, and I managed to deadlift 220 plus again. So I did pretty well with that. So this year, if I can maintain that higher threshold with making improvements, then when I come back to trying to do it next year, I think it's going to be the time to do it. Then that'll hopefully put me in a better position for when I compete, because I probably could have been better if I was able to train how I enjoy training and how I like training for that show in 2022. And when you're going up against the guys who are the best in the world, they're exploiting your weaknesses in your physique, right? That's just what happened, right? So I need to improve my back shots. I need to pose them better as well at the same time, particularly the rear double bicep. I can do better in that one. I need to be a little bit leaner, I think, for the contest as well. Like I say, that comes back to just starting too heavy well the next time round. But I would like to do a few shows. I'll see if I can get a guest spot, because that's always fun doing that. I'm not sure where the Worlds are going to be in 2025. They're in Boston this year. That'd be cool. I've never been to Boston, but I'm not sure where we're going to be the year after. And I'll have to do another show as well beyond that, maybe one in Europe. I loved competing in Germany, and that show's around about October. Whether or not that will be the one that I do, I don't know. And then after that, Steve, I think I'll retire. That'll be it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, no, I've decided 100%. Like at that point, I did my first show in 2006. So that'll be like 19 years competing. It seems like a nice round number that's not a nice round number, but I've done at least 10 pro shows. And that's pretty good going. I think there's not many guys who can say competed 10 times as a pro. The lights have turned off in this room. As a amateur and pro combined, I'll have probably done at that point 35 odd plus shows. And like, I feel like I've got nothing left to prove, man.
You'd only be doing it if you want to go through that process again.
yeah, exactly. And you know how difficult it is. Like we talk about this, right? Every time you do a contest, it leaves a scar. it's hard. It's really, really hard. Look, I love coaching, and I can get a lot of it just helping guys get ready for shows and giving that my experience to them from there. And like I say, I don't feel like I need to do it more.
Yeah.
But after that point. The goal would be to try and win the world pro title, right? I've been second, I've been third, I've been third, I've been second, I've been second. So we can win your class. That would be pretty good going. And if I don't, then I don't, right?
Yeah.
Like, and I'll have produced a physique that'll hopefully be one of the best ones that I've ever produced the next time you compete.
Yeah, that's exciting. I'm sure people will be interested to follow that along, especially if you can bring like that new, a next level of condition that complements your muscularity and symmetry and lines. Mm-hmm. I think that will be a dangerous package to come across.
Well, I hope, yeah, I think so, because I've always had this look, which is that classical kind of look, and I've deliberately sometimes kept myself a little bit softer so I can exploit that, because that's like your USP that differentiates you from other guys. But maybe this time I should just try and get disgusting, but that's hard.
Amazing. Thank you so much for your time, Andy. I'll make sure, like, actually, I don't know, unless you want to say them again, but I'll make sure your Instagram is linked below so people can check those out. And I'm sure with all this kind of work you're doing on the research and stuff, we'll have to chat again.
Oh, no, absolutely. So we're saying you can find me on my Instagram, same place as always. It's Fueled by Scott Soates. You can also find me on my coaching channel on the Instagram as well. That's at the Natty Bodybuilding Coach. And then my website is www.naturalbodybuildingcoaching.com. So you can find me on there. And thanks for your attention, all the listeners. Thanks for having me on again, Steve. And if you've got any questions, just reach out, folks. I'm happy to talk.
Amazing. Thank you so much, Andy. And we'll talk to you soon. Take care.
Ciao.
Losing weight fast while maintaining muscle mass. Sounds too good to be true, doesn't it? It isn't though, it's reality and we know how to do it and we will help you achieve this. The Minicut Movement is an 8-week fat loss program to make you lose a huge chunk of fat while maintaining muscle mass at the same time. We will support you from the beginning to the end so that you see the results you would like to and come out of it much stronger. You'll receive a fully automated spreadsheet that is based on your nutritional needs. You can choose between 6 different male and female training templates. Over 30 videos will guide you through each and every single step of the Minicut so that you're getting the most out of your journey and that you always know what to do. But the best thing is that you can start whenever you want. The Minicut Movement is open 24/7. So if you want to learn more or you're ready to sign up, hit the link in the description below. So let's revive stronger together.